This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 218 to 219 from the chapter Al-Baqarah from the Holy Quran, recited by Ali Parhizkar.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillah innal ladhina amanu wal ladhina hajaru wa jahadu fi sabilillahi ulaika yarjuna rahmatallah ulaika yarjuna rahmatallahi wallahu ghafurur rahim. يسألونك عن الخمر والميسر قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس قل فيهما إثم كبير ومنافع للناس وإثمهما أكبر من نفعهما ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو وكذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون ويسألونك ماذا ينفقون قل العفو كذلك يبين الله لكم الآيات لعلكم تتفكرون.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Surely those who believed and those who fled their home and strove hard in the way of Allah, these hope for the mercy of Allah, and Allah is forgiving, merciful. They ask you about intoxicants and games of chance. Say, in both of them there is a great sin and means of profit for men. And their sin is greater than their profit. And they ask you as to what they should spend. Say, what you can spare. Thus does Allah make clear to you the communications that you may ponder.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
as Hezbollah's drones and missiles continue to rain down on Israeli military bases and settlements, retaliation for the regime's aggression against Lebanon. More Palestinian civilians fall victim to Israel's indiscriminate strikes on Gaza, as the genocidal war's death toll tops 43,800. Also in the headlines, Iran warns the EU against imposing more sanctions on the country over unfounded claims that it has supplied Russia with ballistic missiles. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The Israeli regime presses ahead with its aggression against Lebanon, leaving more civilians dead and injured in its latest attacks.
Somebody!
Death and destruction have become common occurrences in Gaza as the Israeli military keeps pounding the blockaded Palestinian territory relentlessly with air and artillery strikes. In one of the attacks, Israeli warplanes bombed a group of civilians in the Tel al-Hawa neighborhood southwest of Gaza, killing at least four and injuring several others. Several Palestinians were also killed after Israeli jets targeted two homes in the Al-Burej and the Al-Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza. The Israeli shelling of Gizan al-Najjar village near the southern city of Khan Yunis also caused a number of fatalities. This is while on Sunday, a strike on a building in Beit Lahia, northern Gaza, killed over 70 Palestinians, mostly women and children. The Israeli aggression against Gaza began in October of last year. Since then, more than 43,800 people have been killed and nearly 103,800 others injured. Ahmed al-Najjar is a correspondent who joins us from Khan Yunis to tell us more about that. Well, Ahmed, tell us what you have for us this morning.
Well, what we have this morning is nothing but the Israeli aggression continues its attacks against the civilians across the Gaza Strip, starting here from the southern parts in Khan Yunis city, where once again the Israeli fighter drones attack the helpless civilians sheltering in their tents within the so-called safe zone in the western parts of Khan Yunis city. Israeli occupation has designated Al-Mawasi area, which extends between the Khan Yunis city and moves to the north, Deir al-Balah city, as safe and humanitarian area that will not experience any military operations. Accordingly, for people who lost their homes due to the continuous bombardments all over the Gaza Strip and who were displaced from multiple areas, sought shelter there, hoping that they will find safety and will continue to survive. But once again, the Israeli helicopters attacked a tent for Abu Sayyaf family that killed an entire family, a father, a mother, and their two children, and injured one little girl that was critically injured and still receiving treatment, struggling for her life. The attacks have been frequently happening over the past few weeks. In less than a week, it could roughly be the eighth attack within the Al-Mawasi area and the 11th here in the southern parts of the Gaza Strip, as the occupation carried out two attacks within the past 24 hours also in Khan Yunis city, particularly in Gizan al-Najjar village in the southern parts of Khan Yunis city, which attacked a group of the local police members who were trying to secure the aid trucks that is coming from the Salah ad-Din routes and passing within that routes, but they were attacked because the occupation is trying to create a state of chaos and anarchy to and not allowing the needed aid to arrive for the families that need it here in central Khan Yunis. And also another strike was carried in the Gizan al-Najjar village prior to that one, killing at least two Palestinians also in the streets of Maraj in the southern parts of Khan Yunis city. We've come to the middle area of Al-Burayj, which is still experiencing since yesterday a limited ground advancing by Israeli tanks and vehicles that forced thousands of families to flee their areas in the eastern parts of Al-Burayj camp. And actually this morning, the body of a Palestinian man was extracted and brought to Al-Awda Hospital, who was targeted earlier over the night. Also, when it comes to the northern parts of the Gaza Strip, particularly in Gaza City. In Gaza City, over the night, an airstrike targeted a home in Ad-Daraj neighborhood, particularly in Yaffa Street, injuring dozens of Palestinians. The situation worsens also when it comes to the northern part, to the northern cities of Beit Hanun, Jabalia, and Beit Lahia. Where in Beit Lahia this morning, the quadcopters continue to pursue the civilians who are still remaining there, issuing new orders of eviction following a mass massacre that was committed yesterday, claiming the lives of at least 50 Palestinians in the Rabayan family who are still remaining under the rubble and were not extracted. Till this moment, these new orders are issued to force the families to leave the area in the Beit Lahia town and in Jabalia and Beit Hanun and to move south as the occupation is intending to depopulate the region there. This campaign has been going on for more than 40 days now and claimed the lives over 2,000 Palestinians so far. Of them, at least 70 over the past 24 hours.
Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Ahmed Al-Najjar, our correspondent there from Khan Yunis. Thank you. Moving on, the UN Secretary General renews his call for an immediate ceasefire in West Asia in order to end Israel's months-long killing of civilians in Gaza and Lebanon. Speaking to reporters in Brazil's Rio de Janeiro ahead of the G20 summit, Antonio Guterres said that the double standards on the West Asia region must end, adding that international humanitarian law must be applied everywhere. He emphasized the need to address the immediate crises and reiterated the call for a ceasefire and the entry of humanitarian aid to Gaza. Devastating explosion at Gaza's Al-Ahli Hospital in October of last year killed hundreds of people and injured hundreds more. The Israeli regime denied any involvement and blamed the deadly blast on a misfired Hamas rocket. More than a year later, a short film featuring testimonies of a distinguished British-Palestinian doctor who was at the hospital at the time depicts in granular detail what went down on that fateful night. Said Burza reports from the screening of the film in London.
The bombing of Gaza's Al-Ahli Arab Hospital in October 2023. It killed nearly 500 displaced Palestinians and started a raging global debate about who was behind it. The quest for truth inspired When It Stopped Being a War, a short movie made by Forensic Architecture using a 3D reconstruction of the hospital and the first-hand account of a distinguished Palestinian-British doctor who was at the hospital at the time.
The hospital was full, like every other hospital, with internally displaced families that were seeking refuge. And we continued that day operating until around 6:30, when a missile struck the very courtyard where those families were hiding. And the ensuing massacre is now on record.
It would be the first of many more massacres. It was when the onslaught took on genocidal proportions.
The difference between a war and a genocide is that a war tries to change by force the present in order to shape the future, whereas a genocide destroys the present and the past in order to prevent the future from ever happening. The destruction of hospitals was an investment in a genocidal machinery.
The Al-Ahli Hospital strike saw textbook denials by the Israeli regime and desperate attempts at blaming it on Palestinian resistance. Organizers of the film screening at this London cinema say its importance in countering the Israeli narrative cannot be underestimated.
What's amazing about this film is that it reveals the formula. They have a formula and they operate a formula. They did it in Amsterdam and they did it with Al-Ahli and they're doing it all the time. And bit by bit, film by film, we're exposing that formula for what it is and people are understanding it.
Backed by the United States and its Western allies, Israel has murdered countless Palestinians with genocidal impunity and run a disinformation apparatus to cover up its unspeakable atrocities. But as author and journalist Matt Kennard says, it's done it with complicit help from Western media.
As well as the disinformation and misinformation they've regurgitated, they also aren't reporting the reality of what's happening on the ground. And they're also not reporting the reality of Western governments' complicity and participation.
Since the Al-Ahli slaughter, Israel has put almost all of Gaza's hospitals out of service, creating what the World Health Organization has called a public health catastrophe.
As well as debunking Israeli lies about the strike on Al-Ahli Hospital, the film, screened here at this cinema this evening, also exposes the regime's concerted policy of destroying Gaza's healthcare system with deliberate attacks on the healthcare personnel and facilities, a practice that continues to this day. Said Pour is up, London.
Israeli forces have carried out fresh raids in the occupied West Bank, abducting at least 15 Palestinians. Israeli violence and deadly raids in the occupied territories have intensified alongside the regime's genocidal war on Gaza. Iran has warned the EU against imposing more sanctions on the country over unfounded claims that Tehran supplied Russia with ballistic missiles amid its war with Ukraine. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi issued the warning in his ex-social media post, following reports that the EU is planning to target Iran's shipping lines under the baseless pretext of missile deliveries to Moscow. Araghchi said that restrictive measures on Iran's shipping lines would backfire, adding that it would be against the principle of freedom of navigation. The top Iranian diplomat said the EU refuses to reverse its sanctions on Iranian airlines imposed over similar claims that they were involved in transferring missiles and drones to Russia. Araghchi underlined that such behavior toward Iran has no legal, logical, or moral basis. He also reminded that the Ukrainian president himself admitted recently that no Iranian ballistic missiles have been sent to Russia. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thanks for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
World is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among thy servants, of a handmaid from among thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask thee, O he who owns all objects of need, which are granted by his will and hastened to his desire, that thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that thou willst, and givest me mercy from thee. Forgiveness decreases thee not, and giving injuries thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from thee: the facility to obey thee at its beginning, and the favor of thy forgiveness at its end. O he who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sins.
Palestine's freedom movement, notwithstanding the Zionist regime's slaughter of innocent civilians in the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the occupied West Bank and Lebanon, is recorded as an epic struggle destined to overcome Zionism. Concerning this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for more. Press TV wrote, 11 years after Gaza-based resistance movement Hamas clinched historic victory in 2006 Palestinian elections, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair made a remarkable confession. In a 2017 interview with Donald McIntyre for The Guardian, Blair unabashedly admitted to thwarting the Palestinians' democratic choice, a transgression of historic proportions at the time. Blair revealed that he and other global leaders were wrong to bow to the Israeli occupation's pressure, orchestrating an immediate boycott of Hamas after its landslide at the polls. Though international monitors had declared the elections free and fair, Blair, then at the height of his premiership, was ensured by Israel's wicked agenda, folly, swallowing its campaign to discredit both the electoral process and its victor, Hamas. As has been the norm for most American presidents to kowtow to Israel, George W. Bush drove the settler colonial regime's demands to halt aid to and cut off relations with the newly elected Hamas government. Blair often derided as Bush's loyal poodle, a label he earned through his unquestioning support for U.S. policies, also cemented his reputation as a war criminal. He brazenly demanded that Palestinians abandon their democratic will unless they conform to conditions set by foreign imperialistic powers. typical of Western governments caught up in imperialism and a colonial mindset, Bush and Blair insisted that Hamas recognize Israel, renounce violence and abide by previous agreements between its Fatah predecessors and the occupying regime. Austria, then holding the EU's rotating presidency, echoed this hardline stance on behalf of the 25-nation bloc, declaring, "There is no place in a political process for groups or individuals who advocate violence." Vicious efforts to isolate and oust Hamas from political power were spearheaded by Bush and Blair, and as a countermeasure to strengthen the hand of a willing collaborator, they hastily provided diplomatic and financial support to Mahmoud Abbas of Fatah, a futile strategy that clearly failed, with Abbas limping on, linked to a non-existent peace process that delivered zero victories until now. In fact, to this day, he continues limping on the same track. McIntyre wrote that Blair, who became envoy of the Middle East Quartet, composed of the US, EU, UN and Russia, after leaving Downing Street, now says the international community should have tried to pull Hamas into a dialogue. Within a year following Hamas' stunning victory, the Zionist settler colonial regime imposed a stifling boycott as well as an economic blockade of Gaza. An unending 17-year blockade since 2007 that has seen relentless bombings, assassinations, detentions, and denial of basic supplies, which, as Dr. Firuz Osman correctly described, is a policy of extermination. This is what the world witnessed in Gaza today after at least 43,700 fatalities in over 1 year. This exposes the Zionist narrative shamelessly promoted by Western leaders and mainstream media that October 7 happened in a vacuum as a blatant falsehood. The hypocrisy and double standards of the West, which shocked much of the world in the aftermath of October 7, are far from new. The roots lie in the illegal establishment of Israel as a colonial project on Palestinian land in 1948. But for the generation that witnessed Hamas' outstanding 2006 election victory, it was more shocking to discover Western powers warning that they would not deal with a Palestinian government led by Hamas. NBC News reported at the time that Hamas had won so overwhelmingly and fairly. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter said the elections in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip were completely honest. That Carter endorsed the election as free and fair compounded the dilemma for pro-apartheid Israel Western governments. After all, the decisive victory saw Hamas take nearly two-thirds of the 132 parliament seats. The profiling of Hamas as a terrorist organization is not only a ruse, but deliberately manufactured by the Zionist regime and latched onto by its Western lackeys to demonize and criminalize resistance, including armed struggle against the occupation. Not to be outdone by governments linked to the settler colonial regime are Zionist pressure groups who work in tandem with right-wing allies across a range of so-called think tanks, NGOs, and Israeli-funded research bodies. The Zionist playing field in South Africa has been no exception. Pro-apartheid Israel lobbies, ranging from SA Zionist Federation to the SA Jewish Board, have historically been profiling Hamas as a terror group, a tactic doomed to fail both at the national and international levels if they are wise enough to heed the lessons of South Africa's liberation movements. Palestine's freedom movement, notwithstanding Israel's slaughter of innocent civilians in the ongoing genocide in Gaza, the occupied West Bank and Lebanon, is recorded as an epic struggle destined to overcome Zionism.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson. This is Palestine Declassified. We're the only show that's dedicated to investigating and exposing the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's show, we'll be considering the consequences of the US presidential election that saw Donald Trump return to power. The Nelson Mandela quotation that it's in your hands to create a better world for all who live in it certainly applies to the US president-elect. But will he choose to create a better world? His early appointment suggests he may do the opposite. So in our first report, Latif Rabuchakra considers the choices facing Donald Trump as he assembles his team before he's officially sworn in on January the 20th next year.
Donald Trump has a choice in office. He can either, first, reject being a pawn of Tel Aviv by telling billionaire Howard Lutnick and son-in-law Jared Kushner that they're out, and their deranged Zionist war hawk staff picks, which include cabinet positions for Mike Pompeo, Marco Rubio, and Tom Cotton, are too unpopular for his base. He would then rebuild his transition team around closing U.S. bases globally, building infrastructure, fighting inflation, and closing the border. Or, second, he goes with the Lutnick and Kushner cabinet picks and allows them to staff the 10,000 jobs up for grabs. Together, Lutnick and Kushner, along with Zionist super donors like Miriam Adelson, will reshape America in the image of Likud and give even more complete hegemony over the most critical aspects of policy: kinetic war, sanctions, cultural imperialism, currency weaponization, and First Amendment rights to Israel and its intelligence assets hiding in plain sight among the US elite. It's likely that Trump will build the United States of Likud, starting with a new war on campuses and free speech domestically, while empowering Zionist satellites like the UAE and Saudi Arabia, while overseeing a new influx of Hindutva BJP entryists into positions of influence in US society. Contrary to those who believe that Trump is anti-war, his Lutnick imperialism will breed more instability and war. Just as Netanyahu and Kushner's plan to Zionize West Asia during Trump's first term led inevitably to the Zionist genocide of Gaza. Let's remember that Kushner is a major donor to the genocidal Shabbat cult. The Trump victory is a double win for Tel Aviv. Not only is their pawn now in the White House, but their UK assets in the Blairite movement, including Starmer advisors such as Morgan McSweeney, went to the US to advise Kamala Harris to humiliate Arabs, Palestinians, and Muslims. This Zionist strategy has been workshopped in the UK, France, Germany, and elsewhere before. The Zionist plan is to scorch the earth across the political spectrum, to render Muslims and pro-resistance voters in general completely politically homeless and disenfranchised wherever they exist, to ensure Zionist hegemony. The aim is to ensure that there are no mainstream parties of the left, right, or far right in any Western country which can influence or push back against the Zionist project. If the people of Europe decide that they cannot take the established political parties back from Jewish supremacists, then they must start their own and create costs for them.
Joining me in the studio, as usual, is our resident expert, David Miller, who's widely regarded as the UK's preeminent scholarly critic of Israel. David's a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyim University, and is a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch. Our guest contributor today is the celebrated hip-hop artist, political commentator, and podcast presenter for Mint Press News, Low Key. He's currently on tour with his latest album, Soundtrack to the Struggle, so we're delighted that he's made the time to talk to us today. Welcome to the show. David, just explain, will you, what's meant by saying the Zionists got a double win in the US election?
So, obviously, they got a win with their man, Donald Trump, who's a Zionist placeman, as we all know, and I'm sure we'll talk about that a bit more. But also, of course, let's remember that Harris and before her, Biden, have spent the last few years, 2 years, presiding over the unbridled support for the Zionists. And, of course, that's meant the genocide, yes, but it's also meant in the US the effective humiliation of Muslim, Arab-American and American-Palestinian voters. Mm. So they've got nowhere to turn to. Some of them felt that they had to vote for Trump as a result of that. Of course, many more didn't vote at all. So it's about saying that it doesn't, you know, it doesn't matter which person you vote for, because they're both on the same side and both pursuing a specific element of the Zionist strategy. And the Democrat element of the Zionist strategy is to scorch the earth and to make sure that Muslims, Palestinians and Arabs don't have anywhere to go in the political process.
Parallels with the UK political situation.
Absolutely.
And indeed
absolutely.
Europe as well, I guess. But Loki, what do you know about Miriam Adelson and why did she give Trump $100 million?
Well, one thing is clear. The one thing that we learn from history is we don't learn from history. And in the case of Donald Trump, in his first period as president, he was funded by Sheldon Adelson, who is the late husband of Miriam Adelson. Now, both Trump and Sheldon Adelson were included on a list that was leaked from Benjamin Netanyahu's political office and considered to be funders of his first campaign to become prime minister in Israel. This is many decades ago. Now, the relationship between Sheldon Adelson and Trump was so deep that when Trump was running for president, one of Sheldon's conditions was that Trump would announced that Jerusalem was the capital of Israel and build a U.S. embassy there, which even Adelson offered to pay for. Well, so now his wife, the widow of Sheldon, has put similar conditions on Trump, but with a far bigger ask, that being that the West Bank be recognized as part of Israel in direct coordination with the Israeli government, as it absorbs and annexes the West Bank into the political entity of Israel. And so this is really a horrific development. And I think those among us who are looking at some of Trump's isolationist policies elsewhere and feeling optimistic are just simply naive.
Indeed. Well, David, Kushner and even Trump have donated, haven't they, to the Chabad cult that we've covered on this show on a number of occasions. But just for the benefit of our viewers, just a quick recap, will you, on what it is?
So Chabad is a Hasidic sect, one of a number of Hasidic sects. There are maybe 8 or 9 largish Hasidic sects in the world. Almost all of them, with the exception of the Satmar, are Zionist. Chabad is one of the biggest ones. It's a kind of messianic outgoing sect. Many of the other sects are inward looking. They have Chabad has 5,000 branches all around the world, 150 in the UK, and it's ultra Zionist. So it used to be formally anti-Zionist, didn't believe in the Jewish state, but did believe in Jewish colonization, and doesn't believe in giving up an inch of territory for peace, doesn't believe in any concessions to the Palestinians, and in fact believes that it's legitimate to kill Palestinian children because they might in the future grow up to threaten the Jews. So that's the kind of the pedigree of this organization. It's been directly involved in the genocide in Gaza. We covered in the show earlier that they've set up an outpost in Gaza after the invasion of the IDF, and they have, of course, people in the IDF who are followers, and both Trump and indeed especially Kushner, who attends a Chabad show in Washington, D.C., are devotees and funders of this organisation.
Right. Well, Loki, Jared Kushner's reputedly made millions of pounds, or millions of dollars, in kickbacks from Saudi Arabia as a result of pushing for normalisation with the Zionist entity, hasn't he?
Well, I think the most significant aspect of Kushner's role has been the founding of Affinity Partners, which he described as a corridor for Gulf investment into the Zionist entity. Now, what he did was take $2 billion from the Saudi government and also take money from the UAE and Qatar and invest it through Affinity Partners, not only in the Shlomo Group, which is Israel's largest vehicle company and shipbuilding company, which builds all the ships for the Israeli Navy, but also the vehicles that are now equipping the Israeli military. But in addition to that, the Affinity Partners has bought large shares in something called Phoenix Holdings. Now, Phoenix Holdings is one of the largest shareholders in Elbit Systems, which is Israel's largest arms company. But also, Phoenix Holdings has been essential to settlement, development, and other aspects of Zionist colonization of Palestine. So it's in that way that Kushner has served as a conduit of basically bankrolling the Israeli colonization of Palestine with money from Arab governments. And this is really, truly a mark of shame. But also, Kushner is projected to play a very key role in the colonization of Gaza. And that's what his talk about prime waterfront property. Yeah. Can you imagine there are high-ranking business figures with pro-Israeli orientations who are salivating about the property prices in Gaza and beachfront hotels. Sure. We will hear more about that as time goes on, of course.
Yeah, completely amoral, to say the least. But, David, would it be fair, do you think, to say that the Zionist strategy is to completely disenfranchise, a kind of a scorched-earth policy, really, to kind of disenfranchise Muslims throughout the Western world? I mean, is this what the
Well, I think that's what we saw in the US elections. We saw on the one hand Trump being ultra pro-Israel and on the other hand Harris being the same. And what the function of that is to drive Muslims out of political life. The same is the case in this country. I mean, let's remember that a delegation from Starmer's Labour Party went over to help Kamala Harris with that strategy, and of course this is the same strategy. They tried to push Muslims out of political life, and of course they saw some pushback, and there were five independent MPs, four of whom were Muslim. But nevertheless, they want anyone who's Muslim out of the party unless they will sign up to British imperialism and support for Zionism, which of course is difficult for many Muslims, not for all Muslims, but for many Muslims. So that's the issue. And it's the same strategy as we've seen also with the Zionist funding of the far right, of Tommy Robinson and the former English Defence League in the UK, and in the Netherlands with the recent football alleged riots. I mean, that's part of the same thing. It's a deliberate provocation to try and show that Muslims are anti-Semitic and they therefore shouldn't be able to participate in public life. The same has happened in Germany and in France.
Indeed. Well, Loki, I mean, what should people do then, do you think, about the fact that the mainstream political parties in Europe and the United States have been captured by the Zionists?
I think the political sphere now is largely theatre, essentially the management of perceptions. When in actuality, if you study the infrastructure of these states, so for example, the Netherlands, whatever happens on the political level, yes, you have Geert Wilders looking likely to have a prominent role in the government there. This is somebody with a well-established record of dealing with the Zionist lobby and really being an asset of the Israelis. But I think more significant than the political figures who, in an episodic way, are voted in and out, is the changes in infrastructure. So, for example, in the Netherlands, a deal has been signed between the Netherlands Ministry of Defense and a subsidiary of Elbit Systems to outsource the phone hacking and the surveillance carried out by the Netherlands' internal intelligence agency two Elbit systems. This is an arm of the Israeli government. These are the kind of changes that will stand the test of time and will also ultimately be wielded against any rebellious political figures. You have similar arrangements that exist in this state, unfortunately, and in many states across the world. You know, post-2012, perhaps the most consequential but least well-known policy that Netanyahu passed was the move to siphon alumni of Unit 8200 into private companies in order for Israel to seize the neoliberal moment and insinuate itself into the security structures of foreign states. And so I think that's something that really people should concentrate on and be aware of. Political side of things, and nothing proves it more than the Democrats, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. It's just management of perception. Sure. They have very little influence, actually, on differences between what the military does and doesn't do. Someone like Donald Trump, though, now is going to enter into a shock doctrine phase where massive changes will happen, for sure, rather than incremental.
No, indeed. Well, certainly time will see where how dramatic that will be. But our next report now considers whether Donald Trump's rhetoric about free speech will be matched by action after he's sworn in as president on the 20th of January.
The election of Donald Trump has confused many people. On the one hand, Democrats and some sections of the left persist in seeing Trump as uniquely evil after a year in which Biden and Harris almost gloried in supporting the genocide in Gaza. On the other hand, there are those who take his rhetoric about being anti-war, opposed to the deep state, and in favor of free speech too seriously. In one of his speeches, Trump laid out his stall on free speech and tackling corruption, advertising a major assault on the counter-disinformation industry. In recent years, this industry has been the U.S. empire's blunt instrument to cope with the collapse of its global appeal as more and more people gain access to easily digestible information about the nature of the killing machine of the U.S. empire. But this Trump initiative will not do what it says on the tin. While he claims to be an opponent of the deep state, he's perpetually surrounded by its most vicious functionaries. He has consistently appointed them, deferred to them, and will continue to do so. The terrorism clause and the lawful speech clause will be used by the Trump support Nexus and other organs of the Zionist movement to censor all anti-Zionist speech and boost Zionist propaganda across the major social media sites. Because of Trump and Elon Musk's subservience to the Zionist movement, this initiative, a type of which is absolutely necessary, will end up redoubling the U.S. deep state's grip on social media. The cooling-off period for federal employees will not, in practice, cover NATO apparatchiks, like Reddit's director of policy, Jessica Ashu, who worked for the UAE to initiate regime change in Syria and then on other CIA projects, such as promoting the Islamist menace conspiracy theory for the Atlantic Council. Since her arrival at Reddit, it has become a cesspit of NATO propaganda, manned by armies of Psy warriors rather than the freewheeling reservoir of genuine user-generated output. So this policy will have a doubly negative effect. Many naive Americans and other internet users will take this Trump statement at face value, without critically assessing how powerful forces in the Trump orbit will author and guide the policy to subvert every condition of its stated purpose. In reality, this is not a free speech mandate, but one that will be used by all the most nefarious interest groups amassed around Trump to smash anti-imperialist and anti-racist speech online while reaching digital hegemony for Zionists and white supremacists. The online space is the final frontier for Zionists to hegemonize, and free speech is precisely the Trojan horse they will use to do it.
David, tell us about the role of the British Labour Party and the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, because it's been attacked, hasn't it, by both, interestingly enough, Donald Trump and Elon Musk.
Yes, so the Centre for Digital Hate has been at the forefront of attacking Elon Musk and the role of Twitter X under Elon Musk. And it's been part of this disinformation industry apparatus, so suggesting that part of the problem of politics is the control of politics by, one, Russian disinformation, and two, the alleged alliance between Trump and Russia. which of course was the stuff of fantasy, and let's remember also came originally from British intelligence rather than from the US. So the Center for Digital Trade now has an office over in DC, and it's staffed by people, and it's started up by people very, very close to Starmer, and indeed very close to one of the key funders of Starmer, which is Trevor Chin, effectively the leader of the Zionist movement in the UK. The people, same people who were involved in that, Morgan McSweeney, Starmer's head of staff, the chief of staff, went over to help Kamala Harris. Yes. So that they're part of a nexus, which is Zionist, but which is opposed by Elon Musk and Donald Trump, who are also Zionists. So it's the two sides of the factions fighting with each other.
Indeed, a curious state of affairs. Well, Loki, what's your view on this apparent attack on disinformation then?
I think what the Center for Countering Digital Hate and the ADL's type of campaigns against Elon Musk and more recently with a focus on Donald Trump, you have to understand them as part of a shakedown. So one wing of the lobby makes a very clear and dramatic attack on a target, and then the other wing of the lobby benefits from the concessions that the individual makes in order to try and buy off or buy some time or escape some of the scrutiny aimed by one angle of the lobby. So in the case of Elon Musk, what you had was him trying to assert some form of independence against Zionist domination on the platform, at which point the ADL and the CCDH attacks him viciously and actually is able to gain support among the celebrity class against Trump and against particular big corporations. Against Musk. And so really they're one wing of the lobby, which I would imagine acts in some coordination with the other side of the lobby, which engages.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, what do you make then of Donald Trump's son, Don Jr., pushing for anti-neocon appointments like Ron Paul, Tulsi Gabbard and Douglas McGregor?
Well, there's been a big push by Don Jr. He said so. He said he's working hard to get these people appointed. Tulsi Gabbard will be, of course, opposed to the Syrian intervention. Ron Paul, libertarian, not a neocon. Douglas McGregor on Ukraine. I mean, you know, you couldn't have a better analysis of Ukraine from the point of view of anti-imperialism. He's not an anti-imperialist, but nevertheless, his analysis is great. But, and of course, Don Jr. is trying to push these people in. What we've seen since he's said that is a succession of Lukudnik appointments. The UN ambassador, appointment, the new Department of State, Secretary of State, the National Security Advisor, all of them are ultra Lukudniks. And clearly, he's lost out big style.
Indeed, looks that way, certainly. Loki, what do you know about the New York senator then, Elise Stefanik, who's going to be Trump's ambassador to the United Nations?
Well, she's hardcore pro-Israel congresswoman, and she's even gone as far as when being interviewed by Israeli media, she was asked if there was anything that could possibly happen that would cause the United States to withdraw its financial largesse from the Israeli military. And she said there is absolutely nothing that could happen that would force the United States to do that. So ultimately, that is the orientation that Donald Trump will be bringing to the United Nations when representing the United States. So in a way, we can expect similar servility to Israel in the United Nations by the United States.
Yes, indeed. But David, then, but what about all these other names that we're hearing about, like Marco Rubio as the Secretary of State and Stephen Miller as the White House Deputy Chief of Staff for Policy, Mike Waltz as National Security Advisor, Lee Zeldin as the Environmental Protection Agency, with Stefanik, I mean, it's like 5-0 to Likud, doesn't it?
It is 5-0 to Likud, that's right. And I mean, Stefanik is, of course, on record as criticising Trump as being terrible. And Rubio was even worse. I mean, he really coruscatingly condemned Trump and said he was an outrage, he was a fake. And this is the guy.
And Trump is somebody who kind of intends to hold a grudge. So it's quite interesting, isn't it?
Who'll be Secretary of State, i.e., in charge of foreign policy. And effectively, you couldn't have anyone who's more favourable to Netanyahu than these people.
Right, indeed. Well, OK, very briefly then, do you think that Donald Trump's victory and his appointments that we're hearing about make an attack on Iran more likely?
Absolutely. Trump is the individual who was responsible for killing Qasem Soleimani. This was a project that was undertaken in direct cooperation with the Israelis and also with Kurdish forces in the north of Iraq. And he has made no secret that he advocates for not only the killing of resistance leaders in the region, but also the bombing of key facilities in Iran, and even it seemed like civilian sites he was advocating for the bombing of. So I will not be surprised if we see significant escalation on that front, and that's something that all humans should be against.
Right, indeed. Well, all we can hope is that sense prevails then. But I'm afraid that's all we've got time for today. So thank you to our guest, Lou Key, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. So until next time, when I hope you'll join us again on Palestine Declassified, this is Chris Williamson saying bye for now.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Sheikh Rouhani and
Brother Muhammad.
Brother Muhammad. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muhammad. Welcome
to the show. Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
All right, for today's episode of the program Viewpoints, we want to talk about an ancient concept, of course, originally referring to India. I mean, it's called karma. We'll talk about, of course, comparatively speaking, about the same concepts that exist in the religion of Islam or other Abrahamic religions that are equal in meaning to karma. Shaykh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. How do you define karma for us?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. If we simply define karma or karma, very briefly, we say this way or we define it this way that it goes to... For example, to whatever we do in our life, either good or bad, evil or good, according to this idea or this belief, the result of those good and bad actions will come back to us directly in this world.
All right.
And this earthly life. This is the main difference between karma and ma'ad in which we believe in Islam.
Uh-huh.
That is why, for example, one of the beliefs that Hindus have is tanasukh or incarnation.
Yes, yes, yes.
According to them, for example, if you live a well life, a good life in this world, then, of course, your ruh, your spirit, your soul will transform from your body to a better body,
mm-hmm.
a body of another person in this world.
All right.
But if you live a very bad life, an evil life in this world, then of course your ruh or your spirit will transform from your body to a body of maybe animal, because it descends, your ruh descends from the higher level to the lower level.
All right.
It depends on your actions, on your, let's say, deeds that you perform in your life.
Of course, so that's why tanasukh is not accepted by some at all.
Of course not.
No, go ahead.
So then all the results of your deeds will come to you, and you will see it in this earthly life, in this worldly all life, right. Because they do not believe in Mi'ad the way that the Brahmic religions propose. This is karma, a very simple or brief kind of introduction to karma could be like this. But inshallah, we'll discuss that whether it is accepted by Islam or not, what is the Islamic viewpoint on this karma.
That's right. So it refers to the actions and its consequences, isn't it, Brother Muhammad?
Yes, of course. So the definition, the original definition of karma is, it really originates from the Hinduism, where they believe that cause the concepts of cause and effect,
all right.
your actions and the consequences of actions, as the Sheikh rightfully mentioned, they affect both in this life and the reincarnation and the rebirth of the other lives, according to the Hindu
all
concept.
Right.
But no, these days, the concept of karma that is now being somewhat conceptualized among the youths is not necessarily a Hindu concept.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a concept of consequences. So once the youths see that there is a consequences directly related to an action or something like that,